This episode is brought to you by Maine Home and Design highlights the work of Maine's architects, builders, interior designers, and craftspeople. Its pages are filled with architectural masterpieces, home design inspiration, compelling artwork, sustainable practices, craftspeople, and the latest design trends and industry news. Each issue brims with original writing and photography capturing interiors, exteriors, and the heart of Maine homes from traditional to modern styles, and everything in between.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Green Architects Lounge podcast. I'm your host, Chris Briley.
And I'm your host, Phil Kaplan. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Phil.
Welcome back.
Yeah. So we're here for part two of Jacob Ratkusen's lecture. You probably just listened to part one. You're ready to roll with part two. Our cocktail for this episode is the exact same cocktail.
It's a scorched earth. It was so good the first time, Chris.
Yeah, we decided we have to have it again. For this right. one.
Jacob is still going strong. So
still going. He's still talking.
Yeah.
So we'll go by rate.
Will you go and get a refill?
Yeah.
Our drinks.
And go right back to Jacob and all about embodied carbon, plant-based building. So take it away, Jacob.
Thank you, Jacob.
All right. So going a little bit further, and I'm going to start... I know we didn't spend a whole lot of time in the details and the nitty-gritty, and we can get more into that, and I'll tell you why I'm not spending more time on that in a few slides. But I wanted to try and look at, okay, I'm much more interested not in, like, how do we build with straw, like, how do I take a bale and turn it into insulation, or, like, how do I order that panel? I'm interested in how do we convert an industry to incorporate widespread adoption of plant-based materials. That is not a technological problem. In fact, I'm going to be maybe bold, or maybe this is obvious. The climate crisis is not a technological crisis. It is not a technological problem. It is a human problem that is rooted in our values, and more specifically in our values reflected in our economic system. So if we really want to look at how to incorporate plant-based materials, I promise you the hard part is not turning straw into panels. Like, we got that. It's covered. We're done. We're there. We've arrived. The hard part is, how do we get the panels to effectively flow into the material supply chain? How do we get straw to flow into the material supply chain of our building practices when we're looking at one project at a time or one development at a time or whatever our scale is, right? So that's kind of what I want to look at. And we need to zoom out to be able to do that. So bear with me. So my approach to that was looking at, who's familiar with Project Drawdown? Okay, wow, I was hoping everyone's hands would raise up. Now they can all raise, because now you all know this is a really worthwhile use of a 5 to 55 minutes of your evening the next time you've got, you know, something to do other than watch that third episode. Anyways, look at Project Drawdown online. Paul Hawken led a team of researchers to look at the top 100 solutions across all industries to be able to actively reduce atmospheric carbon loading. Really heavily researched. And I was like, great, someone else did research. I'm going to use theirs. And so I looked to see what are all of the things that I generally touch or have some degree of control or engagement with on a project-by-project basis, like building-related stuff. Some of it's a little more around energy, you know, some of it's materials, some of it's controls. They fall into different categories. This is all stuff like, oh, yeah, you know, we either do this or we could do it, or, you know, it could be planned in. So we got about 12. I found 12 things. Two of them were in the top 20, the number one being refrigerants by an enormous amount. So let's just be clear. Putting in heat pumps today is not like a positive check in addressing that. It is actually a proliferation of the villainous refrigerant models that we find packed into today's mini split systems. So if you really want to answer that one, you're specifying CO2 based refrigerant systems for your commercial institutional systems. Go for the Sandin for your hot water or whatever you got to do. But that's just a little asterisk by the, that's a solid, you know, it's more than 50% of the total here. That's no small deal.
Sorry, is that again the blue, reduced CO2e from what?
So that is if we achieve whatever like action points that they've determined within that category or feasible, it will reduce the atmospheric loading of carbon dioxide equivalent emissions by this number of gigatons annually. Yep. Any other questions on that? All right, so you have a dozen things. A couple of them are in like the top two. One of them, you know, if you're speccing a CO2 system, how many people have specced CO2 systems for their projects? Okay, how many people have spec? Okay, yeah, like, yeah. How many people have specced mini splits in their projects? Okay, so we're not on the winning side of that one yet, but we can be, we will be, we're getting there. Okay, so then it's like, all right, well, how about supply chain? Because if really what we're talking about when we're looking at plants, or looking at, sorry, embodied carbon, we're looking at the materials we build with. It's the supply of materials that go into all the products that we're specifying. And we found another 12. There's another dozen things. I'm like, oh yeah, no, this is like either potential, like easy potential, or like within reach potential, or actively specifying things because of these reasons. Everything from sustainable forestry to sustainable agriculture, bamboo gets its own special category, to recycling, right? And it's, we're basically doubling our potential impact by honoring that there not only is an impact in the supply chain of what goes into our buildings, but we can make a significant reduction in the impact of our buildings and actually legitimately draw down carbon dioxide by attending to that and making design decisions and purchasing decisions as if this actually mattered. And five of those are in the top 20. So we actually have like higher impact categories that fall within looking at where the materials come from. So let's get into that a little bit. It's the opportunity and the requirement is that we have to organize material development around these drawdown based, these carbon sequestering and carbon storing practices in their supply chains that link us directly to sustainable agriculture and sustainable forestry initiatives. Because those are industries that are fighting for market share. They have inherently reduced yields by not extracting every potential marketable molecule out of their soil. They're actually leaving some and valuing some integrity in their soil. The yields tend to be lower. These are industries that need viable market support. And this is where we come in as an industry, where we spend millions and millions and millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars on tons and tons and tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of products on all of our buildings every single year. And we can either buy plastic or we could buy sustainable wood. And we have absolute agency in controlling our specifications. Maybe not absolute. I'm giving us way too much credit. We, the collective we, as an AEC industry with all of our regulatory and market stakeholders by our sides, have the ability to leverage tremendous market potential to support those types of industries. And I'm going to give one really tangible example. Number 24, the top 100 things we could possibly do to improve the carbon impact on our atmosphere from across the world and across all industries is improving rice cultivation. And now in California, like, yeah, it's January now. Actually, I haven't checked, but ostensibly we can now go out and buy medium density fiberboard that is being developed directly adjacent to rice cultivation fields in Northern California. And what the big question is always, okay, well, if it wasn't being turned into MDF board, what would have happened to it? Does anyone know what was otherwise happening to that rice? It was burned back in like the 70s and the 80s. And this is like so close to my heart because when I first started getting into straw bale building in like the, it was like the early, sort of mid 90s, that whole architectural field or style developed because of the burning of the rice paddies in Northern California. And they outlawed that practice because of air quality standards. And all these rice growers needed something to do with all of their straw and they were scrambling. And one of the many links that came was a bunch of builders looking for more sustainable building products linking with this glut of rice straw. And that's happening again, but they stopped burning a number of decades ago. So what are they doing now? So now picture yourself, you're in California. The climate is hot, dry, like burning climate, right? We're growing rice. The amount of silica content in those straws means you can't just like turn it into the soil and expect it to decompose. There's not enough moisture in the soil. The tilt is, I mean, the composition of the straw is too tough. The growing cycle doesn't work that way. So what they do is use really scarce water resources, flood the fields, and cause all that straw to decompose anaerobically, letting out enormous plumes of methane so they can replant and restart the cycle again. So now, this is the type of supply chain organization around our material demand that I'm talking about, because the alternative to this, what's like our, what would you expect my most common negative association with MDF board is? Formaldehyde, right? One of the leading causes of bad indoor of carcinogenic exposure in our buildings is millwork and finishes. MDF board is terrible. Stock bulk commodity MDF board, the amount of uranium formaldehyde that gets pumped into that and into our buildings every year is not good. Now, I'm not suggesting that like a tract house builder is going to like take out the urea formaldehyde and put the rice MDF board in instead. Like, I'm not that naive. But suffice to say, like, this is an active organization across multiple industries to replace negative product impacts and practices on both sides and support both industries towards achieving sustainability goals. And we not only have an opportunity, but a requirement as people that decide what's going into the buildings and actively have some agency in how those things are worked to just start paying attention to this and see where we can leverage more good. Yeah.
I know we had major legislation last year on formaldehyde in these products, where I believe that we completed a 10-year cycle where we were drawing up, not drawing it down, but really reducing the formaldehyde in the product.
We Maine or we U.S.?
No, we U.S.
Okay.
So decade-long process where we said now, whether you bring in materials from overseas or make it here, it doesn't matter. Any kind of millwork, casework, has to have markedly less. So, but what I can't tell you is what that is. So my question to you is that still, you're still really concerned about it, even though this legislation is in place now?
I would need to verify the legislation. I tend to be really uncomfortable taking legislated definitions as outsourcing my agency and what is acceptable to a legislated definition. And the example I'm going to give is zero VOC paint, where the definition of a VOC is defined by the US EPA and its impact on the ozone layer. It has nothing to do with the human health metric. So there are a host of chemicals that can be classified, that can be brought into paint. You smell a low VOC paint. Those of you that are chemically sensitive, like, I don't know what you're defining as a VOC, but that does not smell low VOC to me. And the reason is the definition and regulation of VOC. And so I would love to believe that that legislation is meaningful enough for me to feel comfortable. And it may well be, because I haven't looked into it and I'm excited. And what I can say is that a lot of the urea formaldehyde is getting worked out of the equation. I mean, this is not like unknown to the industry. And there's been enough of the, like, was the lumber liquidator and the FEMA trailer crises to kind of raise public consciousness. So that may be a slightly outdated example. I hope it is. I'm like praying that I'm using outdated examples so that we're not continuing to expose ourselves to the same level. But I'd have to look into that. Yeah. I need to tell you about GoLabs. I'm like, oh, you all know. This is like, what a fabulous example, with the assumption that the material comes to market and at a price point that we can afford. You know, it's not out yet, so I always get a little bit nervous, being really excited about something that I can't actually technically access yet, but it's fully online, and this is a great example. Now I'm not just looking at the reduced environmental impact for the sake of reducing building toxicity. I'm just looking purely at the potential benefit in investing in rural economy that is like absolutely critical. And if there's one thing that I don't feel like I need to spend a whole lot of time talking to a group of sustainable builders from Maine about the value of investing in rural economy. I come from Vermont. It's like, yep, we know this is like the entire PR wing of the state is trying to croon about this. My experience is not coming to rural places, talking to rural builders. The vast majority of the time that I'm speaking in front of people, I am in an urban environment talking to urban practitioners about urban buildings and trying to remind all these wonderful urban liberals that rural America exists, and not only exists, but is entirely requisite for the existence of an urban society, because food and manufacturing does not yet have a model for existing within that urban ecosystem. So unless rural America is working, urban America will fail. So there has to be some orientation around all the good liberals building green skyscrapers in San Francisco, New York, that there needs to be legitimate in economic investment in rural America for this entire thing to work. And I can go on it. Home team, thank you for being rural with me. I'm going to kind of count Portland. It's, you know, close enough. There is an entire like social justice and equity lens that we can look at here, right? There is like there are so many lenses that we can look at power that exists within our industry and across society that speaks to this. And the fact that there is, you know, examples of resuscitating industry in rural America, I do not take for granted, and is it exists in a much larger context than just within that economy, that community itself. And honestly, we need solvent rural economies to have climate responsive rural economies. Carbon smart economies have to have enough economic stability to be able to invest in their resilient strategies. So again, unless we're just going to give up on rural America, that economic investment has to be there. So let's couple that with the types of products and land management practices that are also doing net good for the climate. And that also moving more on the sociological side of things, I was talking about that urban-rural divide, you could just take out the words urban and rural and in place the words Democrat and Republican or liberal and conservative. And it is absolutely madness that climate response has become a political wedge issue. It is a Machiavellian masterstroke that we're able to turn our like one unifying human experience into a politically divisive tool. But one thing that is not politically divisive is economic development. And when you look at some of the most conservative industries in operating America, we'll just put mining down, but we can look at forestry and agriculture. Oh my Lord, are those conservative industries. And those are the industries that all of us good liberals trying to save the world with our eco-groovy building materials completely rely upon for all of our hero materials. So therein lies this fabulous opportunity to also align our economic and political and social priorities across some common good. If we need anything in this world, it is some unifying language and some shared goals if we are going to achieve a fraction of what we're setting out in saving our chemical balance in our atmosphere. And herein lies one opportunity of some political and economic alignment. And so kind of associated with that comes these other, so in Vermont, and I expect this is not dissimilar in Maine, recreation is an enormous, I think it's our number one industry at this point. But even beyond that, there is, you know, the ecosystem services that are provided through a working landscape conservation model are really significant. There is not enough money in the world to conserve by no humans allowed approaches of like absolute conservation to save all the land area that we need to save and keep from development. The way we're going to get there is a combination of protecting those most vulnerable and critical corridors and eco-sensitive locations, and also having a sustainable working lands management approach. The greatest threat that we find in Vermont around the sort of health and solvency of our forests is not overforesting, it's development and management fragmentation through private ownership and a lack of cohesive management plan that allows for just a really unproductive forest land, right? Like, that's what we're dealing with. So there is, yes, there is, especially in the world of forestry, there is an enormous tension about the amount of useful product you can extract from a forest and still have that forest have a net positive ecosystem service of storing carbon. Like, that tension is real. That wood will get expensive if there are no other subsidies, because you only can take so many trees out of a forest and have it be healthy. But if the alternative is clear cutting for development, then there is an increase in enhanced value upon having a legitimately viable working landscape model for timber and agricultural industries in our rural economies. And so a few just like great examples of that. Jennifer Martin down in with Hempstone, I forgot to get the name on there, Hempstone in Massachusetts, is now starting to prototype, instead of having to import like perfect hemp herds from the Netherlands or the UK, how we can use the absolute glut of cannabis stock littering New England and turn that into viable hempcrete. And we don't actually have a process developed yet, but let's hear it for the Natural Building Home team to figure out how to find an abundance of a natural resource and like on-site manufacture it into a high-value building material. Like, that's why these natural building techniques continue to be relevant, because we're the ones that are taking responsibility for the manufacturing. I would love it if Owens Corning would be like, hey, maybe we could help with that. But they're not. So Jennifer Martin's doing it. Looking at the cork forest, again, this is another great example where there was a big move in the wine industry to switch to plastic corks, and it really impacted cork production on the Iberian Peninsula, which led to a significant decrease in cork forested ecosystems that were being replaced by developments. And it was this grand illusion in the market that like, oh, it's good that we're not hurting the cork trees by, you know, and replacing it with like safer plastic corks, which is like completely ass backwards from the practical realities on the ground, which is without a market demand, those forests will not stand. And so there has to be a way of being able to, you know, look at land use, land management, market demand, and also still have those ecosystems provide an ecosystem service as well as a material and an economic service. Nori, for those of you that are looking for like real carbon credits, check these folks out. They are selling their carbon credits to regenerative farmers and are actually auditing farming practices, and they are getting into the details of looking at how much carbon is being banked in the soil through regenerative agricultural practices and creating economic incentives for that agricultural model and selling carbon credits based off of that really high bar validation. It's not plantation planting genetically engineered pine that will maybe offset a fraction of the initial clear-cut value in the next 60 years. We cannot talk about any of this without talking about justice. It is completely entwined, and it is all too easy. We've gotten so dangerously good at separating human and social needs from ecological needs and putting these in separate compartments, and they are not. And it is equally dangerous, especially for those, I now stand as a, you know, middle-class, white, articulate, professional male. It is equally dangerous for me to see it as a moral obligation to, you know, help pay attention to justice for some of the people that I need to help. That is a colonialist mentality that also does not apply to this. If we are really going to try to integrate and harmonize all of these different, you know, components of planetary ecosystems and markets and supply chains and industries, we cannot do that in an unjust system. It is for our own benefit and survival that there has to be justice within the systems that we are creating, and holding that in equal value as counting the ticker on carbon and looking at how many board feet we could extract from the forest. And so the sooner we can rally around that and incorporate those goals and values into the practice, the quicker we're going to achieve these goals systems-wide. Because I've been describing these things as components and these individual pieces that we kind of bolt together and look for patterns, that it operates as a system. And if we don't have taking care of ourselves with some legitimate pursuit of justice and equity, then that system is incomplete and will fail. That's really overwhelming for an architect or a builder to try to figure out how to engage in. And I completely get that. And it's super real. And most of the things that I hear after presenting or talking about something is, well, from where I sit right now, my options are to build an unregulated single-family residence in the woods, or I can build my next LEED Platinum skyscraper. And just like to be super clear, this LEED Platinum skyscraper, I can't remember, it's one something plaza in New York. Someone help me. Got a whole lot of press. And it's like, part I got the press was that it's using the like Sirius curtain wall system that's like triple the performance of like the next best curtain wall system on the market, and is still worse than a 2x4 wall insulated with fiberglass. let's be super clear about what we're talking about when we look at sustainable building. And so, yeah, those are kind of like the options that like may seem immediately available to you. And it's really hard to stand from within your little corner of a complex system and look at all these other things that are influencing you and that you have influence over but no direct connection to. And everything seems intangible and far away and overwhelming and confusing. And that's super real if you're trying to look at it from completely within your identity of like, okay, I want to come to work in the morning, I'm going to change my supply chain. Like, yeah, that's not the easiest way into understanding the system. We have to have some mechanism of removing ourselves from our like daily lens and try to look at some patterns within the system as well to see all the different ways and points that we engage, not just as professionals. Or some of us wear multiple different hats within our profession. Some of us may be banging hammers. Some of us are also then making purchasing decisions and may also then be selling projects to clients. Some of us are doing specifications in our next building and we're also running the company and choosing where to be, you know, what markets to invest in and what unfunded research initiatives you want to pack into our next year's operating budget. And then there's also us as humans and people that exist outside of a formal professional identity that have every bit as much ability to, you know, sit on your next electric cooperative board meeting and see what's going on in there or agitate in the streets with your children. There's a million different ways to get involved. And the only way to have some cogency around that is to be able to start to look at all these different parts of the system together so that it just doesn't all feel like a wash. And so, you know, I start with this web look. I'm like, okay, you know, there's forests and there's fields and there's manufacturing and there's recycling and there's code and there's, you know, justice and housing and there's a legislative process and then there's our jobs and these things all work together. And we could go through piece by piece and look at all the different opportunities, but we don't even have time for that. We could spend like the rest of our lives just looking at like all these other potential interactions, but like which one's more important and how to like, I don't know, I still, there's just too many options. So this is where like, I'm already into the super informal, like these are the things that I've been thinking about and talking a lot in the last few months. So forgive the kind of like B-grade graphics here. But my next move is like, all right, let's look at the best organization of systems engagement that I can think of. And this is from Danella Meadows, Leverage Points, Places to Intervene in a System. And her whole piece was like, all right, we want to change a system. What are all the different ways we can get in there and make changes? And some of this is a little wonky. It starts with like numbers and definitions and parameters. And then you look into like some buffer and capacity of how much wiggle room do you have? And then you move up into like time and is time a value that you can use in changing a system? And then, you know, balancing feedbacks, responding to negative change or creating positive feedback loops or how the information flows to be able to make these other, to inform change in these lower systems, the rules of the system, the goals of the system, the paradigm, changing the paradigm, right? You can kind of like get a sense here. And so I took a stab at applying climate response and specifically embodied carbon under that same rubric. Like, what are all the different ways that we can intervene with varying depths of impact on this system and paradigm of the built environment that we're actively trying to change? Oh, meh. Counting carbon, right? That's the lowest form, the numbers. At a minimum, if you can count and have some way of daylighting the impact, we can start making change. That graph where you're like, oh wow, the high performance building is worse than the code minimum building. That is a version of throwing out some numbers and parameters to help to daylight the situation. That's just paying attention to what we're doing. Start there. But that's also the lowest point of intervention. So now, okay, some more buffer. We'll use some lower embodied carbon materials so we won't die as fast. Yeah, it's a lower point of intervention, but it's real. It buys critical time, and if there's one thing we need, it's time. So now we look at like, all right, balancing feedback loops. So we're going to make design practices, not just like I'm going to use that material, but I'm going to change my design practice to favor lower impact materials, stem the bleeding. You could then take that a step towards a positive feedback loop and actually start designing as if optimizing for your stored carbon or reducing your carbon impact is the goal of your design. I get that's like That seems aspirational. That's why we're up a few ticks up in the point of intervention. But if we're looking at places to go, that is a much higher point of intervention than just like throwing some fly ash at your next concrete spec on that one job, right? You can kind of see how this impact starts to stack up. So the next thing is actually get that information out there. Handprinting our best hero buildings. That's footprinting is when you pay attention to what you've done. Handprinting is when you broadcast that and use that as an informational tool to enact change across the industry. And that's what I'm doing, driving for hours to stand in front of you brilliant professionals to be able to share with you some of what I've learned so that you can then inform all of your parts of your, you know, impacts within your systems. Then we can get into the system rules and the system goals, and this is where we start actually getting zero carbon into code, and that's happening. There's a task force of the ICC looking at how to get code into the ICC. There's a group in Vermont looking at doing that with their energy code. You can start looking at programs, and this is where we start organizing the system goals. If our goal is net zero energy, we have completely limited our capacity in our system because all we're going to do is get net zero energy, and it's not enough. It doesn't matter that we're net zero energy. The climate, the atmosphere, doesn't care how much energy we're using. What matters is how much carbon we're emitting. So if our goals align around carbon and not around energy, all of a sudden we have changed the definition of the entire system, right? And that's really impactful when it comes to the regulatory and policy processes.
This episode is brought to you by Pinnacle Window Solutions is focused on providing high-performance window solutions throughout New England since 2009. With 70 years combined experience, Pinnacle Window Solutions has the expertise and knowledge to guide you through the most challenging window and door projects imaginable. More at pinnaclewindowsolutions.net. And Mitsubishi Electric. Make yourself comfortable. Proud manufacturers of the highest quality heat pumps providing quiet comfort and efficiency with the best regional and national support network of installers, distributors, and technicians. Learn more about all of the attractive heat pump options for your home, business, or project, and find a diamond contractor near you at MitsubishiComfort.com. Mitsubishi Electric. Make yourself comfortable. Now, back to the Green Architects Lounge.
And so, yeah, now we really want to get deep and start changing the paradigm. This is when we start changing culture. And that has been an expressed goal of our company. And that shows up in the fact that we're organized as a cooperative. It shows up in the language that we put into our subcontractor agreements. It comes into the integrated design process that we bake into with our design consultants and getting them in way earlier than they generally feel comfortable. There is a host, the language we use, the nonviolent communication that we impose on our job sites. It's all cultural change, and it all orients towards a greater intention around the work that we're doing. And that same intention can be applied to carbon impact, as it can to social justice, as it can to carbon water consumption, as it can just how we treat each other and value each other as humans on a job site so we don't burn out by the time we're 50 years old or 40. So then the biggest thing is identify all of our work as being part of an interconnected global climate movement. And that's where we actually start changing the entire paradigm of our work. And what's super encouraging to me is that we are not alone in doing this. This is not just a few heroes within one industry. There is literally a global movement at foot that we get to be co-participants of and take no small amount of encouragement in seeing that our efforts are multiplied and magnified in association with others with a common goal. So this was my pass at how to more tangibly identify that map and that road from your next spec to if the goal is legitimately getting plants into buildings, that needs to operate within a much larger change of our system. But when we do, this whole host of benefits follows along with, because the system is a lot more impactful than just the atmospheric chemical balance. And so the question that I've been asked by more people, or the most common question that I've been asked in the last couple of months, and I've had hours now of conversations with colleagues, including a really in-depth, you were there, Dan was there, the entire folks there. So for those of you that are not in the NESI community, well, is there anyone that's not in the NESI community here? Okay, good. Is everyone, okay, so do you know what NESI is? It's a regional group of, someone explain him afterwards what NESI is. Get on that. Building Energy Bottom Lines is a peer-to-peer business networking group. It's a program that exists within NESI. And we, you know, there's 10 companies, and we all go to each other's companies and audit them rigorously and shine a brilliantly reflective mirror back on how that company is doing. And the thing that we asked for, our time came up after 5 years of being in the group, or the last original company to go, and our ask is, we're doing all these different things, and it feels kind of nuts that a design build company is also manufacturing doors and designing commercial bathhouses and providing consulting services and doing unfunded research projects. Is this okay? And we spent like 2.5 days with a team of like 30 professionals to like answer that question. Like, does this, like, are we doing the right thing? Does this make sense? Is it impactful? Like, what should I be doing? Is this right? And I've had questions going from, should I leave my firm and make changes from within? And do the work I need to do, or stay in my firm and make change from within my company? Do I leave architecture entirely and become an advocate because I have the resources to do so? Or can I have more impact by being in the field of architecture? I have seen people from the nonprofit sector have a crisis of consciousness and become builders. And I've seen builders have a crisis of consciousness and go into policy work. And we're all trying to figure out what to do. And it is super legitimate, and I don't have any answers beyond what ones I'm trying to find for myself. I could tell you things, but they wouldn't be your answers. They'd be my answers for you. But what I can say is the question is completely appropriate, and you can find direct lines of association with a global movement of young people of color that are identifying themselves as leaders and putting themselves into the firestorm of social media to be able to find a voice of activism and engagement in their work. And so I promise you, if these folks can like find a voice and a place of advocacy and power within their worlds, I guarantee you that what you choose will be fine. Just do it and then mess up and then figure out what went wrong, and then do it again or do something different and do it quickly, and just see how nimble and flexible you can iterate that design project of your life if the problem that you're having is paralysis by analysis. And I only say that because I'm hearing a lot of that amongst a lot of us. And I just want to encourage that, like, we don't have the luxury of navel gazing and wondering if we're being the most uber hero that we could be. Do the thing that you figure out that you can do tomorrow, and try to set a goal and your own process for goal setting to figure out where in the movement you best stand. And the thing that I have been getting increasingly frustrated with as I go from conference to conference to conference, and we hear these like increasingly dire and existential messages coming from, you know, these thought leaders in our industry and across other industries, and there is like zero mechanism whatsoever for legitimizing the like traumatic emotional experiences that associate with like reckoning with existential, you know, grief in our daily work. And I may be like a little more on that end than some of you, but when I'm doing this research work and I'm looking at, you know, here's like 16 different scenarios of how we could get to a zero carbon economy by 2050. And in 12 of them, our civilization collapses and we effectively all die. And holding the grief around that, and holding the grief around putting mini splits into my house of my next project, knowing that the refrigerant that is packed into that is the number one action item in Project Drawdown, and I'm still doing that. Like, there needs to be some like honest reckoning of the fact that this is incredibly painful and difficult work to show up for on the daily. And if our goal is to save the planet and deal with climate change and be real about our work, then we have to accept that it's really painful and it's really hard. And it's really hard to do it the next year and the fifth year and the 10th year and the 20th year. And our society is terrible about supporting a good, healthy work-life balance on a good day with no emotional content in our work. And then you just like layer on like the existential dread of watching like rainstorms in northern Vermont in January. And I just want to like say that that's real and it's okay to be upset. And if you need to cry, that's all right. And I've like cried three times in the last year in these presentations because it's just so overwhelming all the time, both in how hard it is and the like incredible potential we have to do so much good. We hold so much opportunity if we can just allow ourselves to show up for it and see the patterns for what they are and figure out how we can engage in a proactive way with those patterns. So what's the best antidote to that? That grief, the trauma, the exhaustion.
Community.
What?
Community.
Yeah, community. But that's not the answer that works to that next slide. So that, but it actually goes to the last slide. You stole the punchline, but that's awesome. That's like the best thing you do. So on a more like practical thing, because community is a bit of an abstraction. What is practically the greatest thing that we can do to address existentialism and grief? Action. I don't know about you, but for me, the most healthy thing I can do is take some form of action. So I didn't want to like throw all that out there and get super heady and look at these systems interventions and get all that without giving like some legitimate like, here are some things that we could do literally tomorrow. And this is not heavily curated and peer reviewed. This is like stream of consciousness after going through the slideshow a number of times. Just start where you are, up your game. You know enough now to know that what you're doing could be better. So do better with where you are right now, because that doesn't involve heroics. It just involves paying a little more attention. Better materials, bone up on building science. You're here tonight. Thank you. Like if you don't even show up in the room, then you're not going to be able to do anything with the information in the first, you're not going to have the information in the first place. So start where you are, up your game. Now do the next thing. Maybe for some of us, that's like getting a little more focused for those of us that have a tendency to be a bit hyper expansive in our practice and can't ever really actualize the goals of any one of our multiple foci. So figure out what it is for you, but like, you know, maybe there's a business model shift that will allow you to be more impactful with the work that you're doing and maybe even more profitable at the same time. Educate, like educate and educate and educate and educate. Everyone needs to be educated. We all need to be educated. We need to educate ourselves. We need to educate each other. We absolutely need to educate the marketplace. There is like, we are up against people that make more money in a year than I will ever see in my lifetime to confuse millions of people to buy things that they shouldn't buy, but they think that they're doing for a reason that is undermining their own best interests. So we talk, or many of us talk with clients on the regular, and we hold way more credibility than the suits with the glossy papers, because we have the time and are required to take the time to develop personal relationships with our clients. Leverage those relationships for education. Provide a low carbon option in every proposal, even if you know they're not going to go for it. Even if you tell them, like, I know you're not going to do it, but it feels really important for me to put this out here, and here's why. Invest 5 minutes of conversation and maybe 30 minutes of your own time to figure out what would I do if I wanted to do this without foam, and make it visible to the marketplace, because it is literally the only place they're even going to know if there's another option. And I can say that from experience, because we helped develop straw bale architecture for single family residential construction in rural Vermont. So if we can educate a marketplace enough to have a thriving building with that technology, I promise you there is work that you can do to help push the envelope further for your clients. Tell. And I know Dan has been like passionate about this. Others of you that are interested in Votech, there is a crisis in the trades right now. There are not nearly enough people in the trades period, let alone trades folk that are, you know, qualified to execute the work that we're talking about. That exists in the design world too. There just happens to be more soft cost investment for professional development in the design world and more people moving in there because they tend to make a little more money on an annual basis. So in this case, like, there's a particular need on the construction side. Although, hear me, that translates into the world of architecture as well. I've had plenty of architects come out with a master's degree in the field that still can't identify the three forms of heat transfer in the universe. So also, yes, architects as well. But there is a particular need in Votech. And to be able to legitimize the value of VOTEC as not a second-class citizen, you know, like, sorry, yeah, you're not college track and you're doomed to, you know, subservient labor. That needs to be held in the same value as STEM programming and aligned so that analytics and energy modeling is taught to the construction trades in the high school VOTEC programs. So if you engage in that world, there's another point of intervention for you, and on and on and on. Join or take over a professional association. I know in Vermont, the Home Builders and Remodelers Association is essentially run by passive house builders. It's awesome, but you look nationally, so for those of you that have a point of intervention within your more traditionally conservative trade association, they need you because you can pass and talk that language and intervene. It is one thing that I hold as a like non-college educated, building trained, rural bearded Vermonter is that I can get into conversations with folks that generally don't hear my perspective. And so I see that, okay, there is a point of intervention that I am specifically allowed access to be able to leverage. Find your own point within that and the association that works for you. We're all here right now. Yay. If you haven't joined, join. These associations hold their power by membership. So if you believe in their cause, NESE, Carbon Leadership Forum, Environmental Embodied Building Network, et cetera, you know, that's a good place to invest so that you can leverage the power of a group. Get political. There's two different ways of doing this. You can do it as an informed citizen, and then you can also leverage your political weight as a business owner for those of you that are in that position. And I know in the like libertarian state of Vermont, business owners are given a significant amount of political clout in a conversation. Oh, well, if he says it's not good for the economy, then I guess we probably shouldn't pass the carbon tax. So, you know, as a business person, I can speak in favor of policies that may conflict with my dominant trade organization, but that's all the more reason for me to use that platform to do so and to not be afraid of getting into those political waters if you see you have a leverage point in there. Or do it as an individual. And don't forget the social side. I mean, my God, we're at a point now that just like volunteering is an act of like radical disruption to the dominant cultural paradigm that is forming in America. So like you do that and you are literally culture changing. Because right now the trend is dramatically in the opposite direction. But you can get more specific, you know, train yourself up on being a good ally in racial and anti-racist and anti-racism activism in your community, right? As like, as a white, cisgendered, heteronormative male, I have like had to devote significant energy to figure out how to ally with my trans and queer building partners and design partners. Like, it's a work I had to do and that I found incredibly rewarding and like takes some effort, but is a fundamental part of this entire organism of paradigm and social change to enable what needs to happen to also save the atmosphere. Find your way forward and just don't be afraid to, you know, take a couple of slings and arrows on Facebook because that's what's required at this point. So I have went way longer than I was planning. I'm just assuming it feels like I've been talking for hours. Ooh, yeah, sorry, thanks, oops. I just want to leave with a metaphor because I love metaphors. They're helpful, they're grounding, and the reciprocal roof just seems absolutely perfect in this case. Anyone that's not familiar with a reciprocal roof, it is this very elegant system. It's a circular form in which a series of small repetitive members, none of which hold significant structural capacity by themselves, support the member on top and are supported by the member underneath and create a distribution of the structural loads that dramatically reduces thrust. So you can create these big, large, uninterrupted open spaces in which large groups of people can gather. And if there's ever a metaphor for us as individuals within our companies, for our own silo within our AEC industry, for our industry within our global supply chain infrastructure system, and as people on the planet, be a rafter. All right, I'll stop. Thank you.
Absolutely, I can stay as
long as people are comfortable.
Hand, I'm not sure that our hosts can.
Is there so a, there if you want to recommend a watering hole at which we could then decamp to, that's also an option. I'll leave that up to the group. But questions right now for those of us. Thank you for staying so long.
So, let's look at three questions.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll let you moderate.
Okay.
Yeah, so conventional refrigerants you find in your mini splits. It's even worse in like the world of commercial like coolers and freezers and like you know your convenience store beer fridge. The global warming potential per unit mass of those chemicals, thousands of times the impact of equivalent mass of carbon dioxide. So they're just incredibly potent global warming impact chemicals. It's also like, it is no small irony that like the number one hero move in drawdown is like quite possibly the least sexy intervention you can imagine. Refrigerants. It's like, I always, every time I think of that, I think of the Graduate when like Buck Henry's like plastics. It's like, so, I mean, that's what it is. And like all those beer store, you know, those beer cooler refrigerators are like leaking refrigerant, like, I mean, even before they leave the factory, because they're just like cranked out and mass produced. And these like hugely high impact chemicals are just getting spewed up into the atmosphere because of this. One, it's not given the quality control it requires because the industry doesn't recognize the impact fully. And two, the next generations of lower impact refrigerants just haven't fully matriculated through the market. And so we see that more in commercial scale stuff. Like we did a big, was involved in a project for the Vermont Food Bank, which has this big like 60 by 40 by 20 like drive-in cooler for all their food distribution. They're at a scale where they could economically justify going to a CO2 based system. And so now they're like 2,500 global warming potential chemical got reduced to a one global warming potential chemical. So that's like the rough. Spec CO2 based systems. That's the action item.
I want to follow up on this. So are you saying, just hypothetically in Maine, electric baseboard heating versus a heat pump, what's the answer?
Too many externalities to answer that directly. So this is the way I go about thinking about that. I would look at the operational impacts. I first look at the operational energy consumption on an annual basis. You know, you got a COP of 2.3, I don't know which y'all use, that's what I use, versus, one for baseboard. So you get your loads there. Then you need to look at what grid you're on. If you're on ISO New England, you look at the carbon factor for that, and then that will multiply out to tell you, hey, that's my operational impact. And then you can look and see how much of that, say again?
Times the heat loss of the
building. Yes, absolutely. So I'm kind of like assuming in your energy calculations, you've gotten to the point that you know like what your actual usage is. Calculate out on those two different, like, appliance scenarios. So then you'll be able to, okay, that's the operational. Oh, sure, heat pumps win. Absent good data of looking at the total embodied carbon profile of either a heat pump or your baseboard, and there is work being done on that, really what you need to look at is how much of this refrigerant do we think we're going to lose? And that's a really hard question to answer. The nice thing about cold climate heat pumps is they are a way higher quality product than your average convenience store chiller. So there is much lower loss in manufacturing, and most techs that are working on that like are honestly trying to avoid leaks. And there's an honest attempt at recapture when they decommission a system. But like, an actionable item would be if you're specifying that system as an architect or as a GC overseeing a sub, that you make sure that like the refrigerant tech that showed up hungover and like late and rushing to get to the next thing doesn't like shortchange a quarter crank on the connecting bolt to like, you know what I mean? Like some of those quality control mechanisms, we might need to level up on that. But in terms of the simple answer, you'd really need to look at what is the actual refrigerant loss in the system. And in the absence of being able to answer that, well, what can I do to minimize it knowing that any is bad? That would be my answer.
Great. One more question, briefly answered.
That was brief.
Building design, we worry about and invest a lot to Mm-hmm.
And what about the embodied carbon window?
That is a great question. So those like... Okay, so the question was, what about all the products that we incorporate into our assemblies to achieve stringent airtightness requirements? Ah, buddy, 475 shout out. So it's real. What's really hard right now, I promise I'll make this quick, on a product by product basis to get really good information. We just don't have enough data to like do direct product comparison. What I can say in general is there's like polyolefin, like space age, you know, like magic vapor variable sheets are pretty high impacts. And we use like this much of it in the building to achieve these like really critical services. So that's a place where I would assign like appropriate technology. Like if it's a question of having a leak in your house or saving that embodied carbon, when we start looking at impacts of building degradation and condensation problems and mold, then like that's not worth it. However, we have been able to achieve passive house level airtightness using clay plaster systems. So is there something else that you could use other than that membrane if you have an overarching goal, not of like quantifying the products and adding them up, but taking a systems perspective, are like, what are the favored materials that generally align with these other principles and recognize you could achieve airtightness without the use of those films? And what I will say is we do not use one part spray foam for air sealing, mostly because it's crap and doesn't work over time. And also because we can achieve a better result for essentially the same installed cost using a relatively low embodied carbon. And I say that hedging because I haven't actually looked at the sheet, but just looking at the ingredient list, a pretty benign tube of caulk and some backer rod. So that's my answer.
Well, and there you have it. That was Jacob.
Jacob Rakusin from New Frameworks. Espousing brilliance all over this country of ours and really inspiring us and really has become one of the faces of this movement for embodied carbon.
Yeah. One of the things that I really took away from that speech was the one of his comments that he made about, you know, the urban built environment being very dependent on the rural community. And that works also, you know, politically, and how, you know, there's this real camaraderie that we all should have, both rural and urban, and this partnership that we need, you know, to grow our urban buildings in our rural communities, and how.
Well, that was a huge eye opener for me too, Chris. This right. whole social justice piece of this. That as geeks we can look at these numbers, and that's all we really care about. Like we can make this building, you know, a little geekier.
Yeah,
but we're missing the big picture here,
right? About getting to the root of what's how to get it done, community and building a political will and a community will to really change the way we build our buildings.
Yeah, he said it best, but I think you know our role as architects, you know, we really need to get this into our heads a little bit more than we typically have, frankly.
Yeah. So that's it. Episode, or whatever. It's part two.
Part two.
Of the lecture. We'll be back with some fresh material. Maybe we'll interview somebody and we'll talk about a great topic on our own.
You want to talk about the song?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, we're going out on a song. So you just listen to Jacob. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, I don't know if it's said, you know, he's called Deva, D-E-V-A, that's his middle name. So sometimes somebody will slip and just someone who knows him will call him Deva. So his band, or did you know, Phil, that he plays both drums and saxophone and plays with multiple bands. So while this guy is like staying up all night doing all this research and running a company and building things, he's also, you know, skipping out the back door with his saxophone and drums and playing in clubs and all over Burlington and stuff, and laying down tracks.
Dude is cooler than me, and I don't know when he sleeps.
I don't either. I think he has a clone. Yeah. Anyway.
So can we go out on this song?
Let's go out on this song. One of the bands he records with, mm-hmm. you can actually find on Spotify. So we're choosing that one. The band is called Malmaze. And this is a song called Phantasma. You know, it's great. A very different vibe, and really wonderful to have that singing through the studio. This cultural polyrhythms, it's great.
Very cool. Well, enjoy, everyone.
Yeah. Cheers, Phil.
Cheers, Chris.
Sobreviviendo en la calle yo lo vi mentir. De sola en la cantina sus penas ahogó y a sus frenes olvidó. De al bar y coque y guaracha y lo que andar y no se volvió. ¿Cómo voy a reclamar lo que me hago?
Solo soy un fantasma.